Okay. You had a question before we went to the break.
Me?
Yeah. Before we start here.
It was a drum tuning question. You talked a little bit about how to tune a snare relative to whatever else the rest of the band is doing.
Hit record again.
With toms, though, how do you approach tuning them? Like, how do you tune them relative to whatever else the band is doing, and then also how do you tune a set of toms relative to each other?
Can I?
Good.
Thanks,
Fella.
Fella.
Go for it.
Take care of that.
There's no rules. however, it does depend on the context of the mix. If you've got super fat bottom end, if you want the drums to cut through more, typically I might pitch them up a little bit. And oftentimes, how they tune their drums to their own ear doesn't necessarily translate to how they come across in a recording. In live, in particular, we used to just record, you know, 3-4 bands a night, and these drummers would have their toms. They sound so cool all by themselves, you know, when they're hitting them alone. And the rack tom is doo doo, and the floor tom is doo doo. You get it in the mix, and it's like flap flap. That's all that's left. You need to bring those pitches up to where there's more of a note, especially if it's a metal band. We recorded everything from death metal to, you know, singer songwriter. It has mostly to do, in my opinion, with the context and, you know, preference. You have to respect the drummer's particular sound. But I would just say, suggest gently and let them hear. Just do a quick, you know, roll. Well, you don't roll tape anymore, do they? spin some disc and let them hear it, you know, and then, you know, bring the pitch up. And then it doesn't take that long. But it's certainly a lot less time than going back and recutting the drums when you can't get them, or you're trying to EQ the hell out of them, and you know, that just doesn't sound good.
Samples.
Yeah, there you go. Trigger everything. And in terms of the overall, you know, quality of the kit, I only use like a 4-piece anymore because I'm, you know, lazy and weak. But I like getting a fairly wide range, but still having them cut. I don't tune to specific pitches in terms of a chord. I don't know anybody that does, unless it's a song that you want that. You know, I'll do some stuff where I'm playing with my hands, and it's all about the pitch, or with mallets, and I will actually tune them to usually the tonic or the fifth. That just depends, but there I don't really think that that's necessarily what you want to do, because you don't want to define the tonality with the drum set, and thankfully there's usually enough interesting, you know, character in the drums to where they kind of find their own voice, you know. And I've even done things with a djembe where I'm trying to get sort of a bass drum type tone out of it, and people swear when they hear the mix that the djembe is playing the note in the chord, and that's just the ear, kind of, you know, it's an illusion, but the ear kind of tends to quantize or interpolate pitch, and if it's low enough. But I guess, you know, all in all, make sure they're not too low, unless you've got 10 toms and you want the one on the bottom to sound like a bass drum, which is appropriate if that's what you're going for.
All right, good. Thank you. So let's go on to the toms now. So we've got 15 minutes here.
We'll do this quick.
Okay. This is just a demo.
Give you an idea.
Talking about the differences.
Okay.
Maple.
So...
Jasper.
Old.
Old. This is from
1955. It's the only drum I've ever found that's older than me.
Yep. And this is chrome plated aluminum. And they're not tuned to try and be anything like each other because we don't have time. But.
And that's dry by design.
Very dry.
It's got like a pinstripe, coated pinstripe. And I also put, I haven't touched it. It's set up for a session. But you want that fat, soft, thick, sandy kind of
I won't hit it
dry.
As hard.
Yep.
So in the center, you get that nice, just fat.
Do we want to sample each one of these? Do we want to do that? If so, we're going to move the mic around.
Why don't we just sample one of one drum and one of the other drum? I'm not going to be able to keep track of all of them.
Okay. Yeah, one of, well, there's three drums, so let's do one
of each. This is going to be the most different.
Okay. Okay.
So fundamental round 175, 180. So moving on.
Interesting. We're kind of close. You can see that one mode that's two or three higher is a lot, that peak is a lot higher there. So that, to me, that's kind of that ring that you're hearing in that
right.
one that you're not hearing in the other.
And then this is the maple.
They all look like snare drums.
Yeah.
Sound kind of like them, too.
But they all are different. What's weird is they all sound a little different. You know?
Can I get that last one more time?
Yep.
There we go.
Is the ringing necessarily bad?
No, and if you take all of that away, then in the mix, there's nothing else left, really. You know, you do that to the drum.
Right.
In the mix, you do that, a lot of those overtones and harmonics get swallowed up by the other instruments, but you're still left with the tone of the shell. You hear the drum come through better. If you take all that away on the way in, and that's what you're recording, you can't bring that back.
Right.
And it's a quick way to make your drum sound real farty and poopy. Those are very different things. Farty drums and poopy drums.
If you're gaining the drums, then you're going to get rid of some of that, but you still get that initial
sure.
sound.
Sure. You will still have the harmonics. Yeah. Yeah. And nobody hardly ever gates anymore, at least while tracking, because that paints yourself into a dangerous, dangerous corner.
But PA people gate all the time.
Yeah,
sound reinforcement.
Live stuff, yes.
Live stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are there any tips on gating, setting up the gates?
Don't.
I always worry about yeah. I always worry about losing stuff.
Well, when somebody's got a drummer
really
playing a lot of ghost notes, and they're doing this in between every backbeat, and that's part of the groove, and you've gated it so that all you're getting is that, you're missing 90% of what that drum part's supposed to be about.
Unless you know the drum part, and you work with that group all the time, and you can know that this song,
but if
it's going to be
just
steady.
Just come in for a gig that night, and you've never heard them before, and now their snare just goes...
Even on toms, particularly with gating in a live situation, I totally agree with you on the gating in a recording situation. Just don't, who cares? But in a live situation, you'll find drummers too, like with a front of house guy or a monitor guy, particularly if they're on ears or something like that. Mm-hmm. The guy's going to try to do a dynamic roll, and he's not going to hear the first part of the roll, and it's going to drive him insane. I'm hitting it. Why can't I hear it? It's going to drive him nuts.
I mean, nobody ever gates the guitar player.
No.
No, they have other things for
that. Do the reverse gate where it gets off as he gets louder.
Are we going to talk about miking the bottom head on the snare at all? Is that...
Yeah, please do.
Sure.
For years I didn't.
I'm gonna give you
I just didn't do it because I was lazy, and
there's a theme.
And
here.
I always got a good sound. What I thought was good. By the way, this is for like a singer songwriter with piano and bass. This tuning, where it was to sort of just, you know, little setting. I've got my live snares now. It's kind of nasty, I think, but it's all good. It's all it depends on context.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, one of the things that that I learned by Mike and Bottomhead is having more control over the ghost strokes. I play kind of a funky, some jazzy fusion type stuff, and I'll play a lot of that. And I really, just being able to blend, getting that snare just to top in. Oftentimes the fader's only up like an inch and a half. I mean, it's so subtle, but man, when you bring the whole mix up and you take it out, it's like, oh, you know, and you put it back in. It really is effective, especially when you're doing ghost strokes and a little, I'm sure it's a common trick for most people, but if I don't want the backbeat to have as much, you just compress it, limit it,
mm-hmm.
and then so that the accents aren't going to be, you know, that prevalent, the sound will change, you know, which is fine, but it won't necessarily punch through as much, so you can sort of just bring that little bottom layer up a little bit and position it just right. I find it helpful.
Two things that can be...
Oh, I was going to ask you, but go ahead, please. Mm-hmm. No, please go ahead.
I'll be quick. Two things that are really useful to use the bottom snare mic for are as a reverb send, because usually that bottom mic is more isolated from things like hi-hat.
Sure.
It's usually pointed away from the kick drum, so you're not getting a lot of that. And most of the time you're high-passing it a bunch anyways. But you can use that if you need reverb, just to sort of, it's the impulse for the reverb. But now the top mic, which has all this shitty hi-hat bleed stuff, isn't going into the reverb and splashing everything out. The other thing you can do with that bottom mic is use it to key a gate on the top mic. If you're getting a lot of spill in the top, key it from the bottom because the bottom's more isolated. So now every time the snare hits, you're opening the top mic, but you're not doing anything to the bottom mic. So you're still getting some sustain from the wires. You're getting rid of the cruft on the top mic, and you're left with a much better sounding drum than you might be. Many times.
Sure.
Sure. I mean, all you're really looking for on that bottom mic is the sizzle, and you get rid of kick bleed that is coming in. I tend to high pass a lot of stuff a lot, just to get rid of whatever doesn't need to be there.
Are you just putting 57 under it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you can try whatever. That's all I do. 57.
And what about the phase?
There you go.
Always check.
Question about the phase between top and bottom.
One will be out most of the time, but then you also have to deal with the overheads because one is going to be out with the overheads. I tend to default to flipping the phase on the overheads, leave the top snare mic in phase, and flip the bottom, and then things tend to work out. But I always check every mic to the overheads in mono anyways.
That's exactly what I was going to talk about, the relation between the
snare.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, a different depth snares will also...
Different phase correlations.
Yeah,
it goes into what you were talking about, the relation between basically this up and down.
Right, especially if you're high passing things, right? Because the lower frequencies will tend to be in phase with more in phase with each other, whereas the higher frequencies are going to be different.
Because of the wavelength.
Yep.
Okay, so we're talking about skipping the rest of snare. Is there any other snare things that we want to address?
We feel like
we
talk a lot about snare.
Before we skip. Rick?
On the rim, so you said that was made out of aluminum. I've heard about steel snares.
On the hoop the tension rods go into? Zinc, brass,
wood,
rarely aluminum. It's too soft. These days, most flanged hoops are rolled zinc, and most cast hoops are brass.
And a lot of drummers hit the rim at the same snare.
Right, a rim shot is when you hit the rim and the head at the same time, which is not to be confused with a cross stick, which people call a rim shot, which is incorrect, and they should be shot.
So what's that?
We're going to talk about snare drums now. Sorry.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yep.
We're flexible.
We are.
Okay, so this will be loud. This is a rim shot. So I am hitting the rim at the same time as I'm hitting the head. Versus that's just the head. I'm not hitting the rim. it's impressively loud. This is a cross stick. Good for ballads and Celine Dion songs. And many people call this a rim shot. It is not a rim shot.
It does confuse the living part of everyone that will say that. Because I've had people say, dude, I really like that part where that rim shot's in there. And it'll be like...
the real quiet part. Like, the sensitive part.
You mean that.
I got you. I feel you. Then there's stick shots.
Right. There are stick shots. Ain't no stick, though.
Boom.
Can I stick back now?
No. Now that it's ruined?
Which, if you listen to a lot of Dixieland, you'll hear those.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, right.
Old style jazz.
Yeah, early jazz stuff. Mm. Baby Dodds and whatnot. Lots of that. Shitty tricks things that I do.
When your buddy Rich gets.
When your buddy Rich.
Have we talked about different heads yet?
No, I can grab some heads and we can talk
Let's talk about heads.
Because actually I have all 14-inch heads, too.
Okay.
Let's try them all on this drum.
Yeah, we'll give us about 30 minutes between each one and we'll see that.
Yeah, talk amongst yourselves.
Yeah, exactly. So we will start with an Ambassador Clear, which is a single ply clear head. Which, as you can maybe imagine, it's going to be fairly bright.
Why would I imagine that?
Well, maybe you wouldn't imagine that.
I don't know how to predict what
I'm saying. This is what an acoustic head sounds like on its own with nothing.
Did you say no ambassador? Shell.
Ambassador.
Yeah, it's a clear ambassador.
So Remo is the brand, Ambassador is the model. So there's a little tension on it, where it's crimped into the hoop, but it wobbles for a while.
And what will it do once it's tight?
But it won't sound exactly like that one, because that's a different
head. This is a two-ply head.
Okay.
So this is the coated version of that exact head, meaning it has a rough coating on top of it.
So if you're playing brushes.
Yes. You want to do that. It gets a little warmer.
It's shorter note-wise.
Let's do an A-B with that.
Yep.
Similar pitch in the... It's short. Yeah. And it will sound that way on the drum.
Yes.
Just putting my mighty speakers to the test here.
It'll be all right. Clear heads a lot of times are used as the bottom resonant heads on toms because it will open up a little bit more. These are generalizations because there are a lot of people who will also put coated heads on the bottom. They're different, so it depends on what you're looking for.
Is there a price difference amongst these? So if somebody's cheaper, has no budget? A
couple cents for coated versus clear, probably. Totally. They're super close.
A lot of people swear by, I mean, they're rare, few and far between anymore, but somebody like Sheila E., she uses these single-ply clears on her batter head. And it's really bright. But she plays a lot of Latin and a lot of jazz where everything needs to cut through really, really dramatically. So then we're going to move on to a clear Emperor. Again, this is Remo. Again, so this is a two-ply head. And so it's going to be a little thicker.
This is the clear version of what's on this drum. Two-ply stuff doesn't hang on quite as long because you've got more mass. It will, when tuned up, especially on toms, you get kind of a shorter, greater depth of tone on the two-ply head, where single-ply head you can open up a little bit more. So depending on the context of the music, you may want more or less sustain. Two-plies are going to be a little bit shorter, but kind of sound more powerful and punchy.
Should it be that the harmonics will resonate less on the two-ply head? Is that what you're saying? Is that what he's saying?
In theory.
Yeah, in theory.
That. That's the kind of sound that I envision. More of the pitch.
You've got some friction between those heads,
right, exactly.
And some damping.
Yeah.
So it's going to have less sustain, and especially those higher order modes are going to damp out quicker.
And still yet fairly slappy, because unlike the other one, which is an Emperor, what's on this, that's coated, this is going to be a little warmer, and it's going to have a... Not as slappy as
we're getting into the deader kind
of,
which is sort of like what was on this drum.
Yeah.
You heard, you could tell the difference.
And that has even more damping.
Right.
It has, there's glue
the ring
on the outside edge between the two plies on that. So that's absorbing even more high frequencies, the harmonics that are at the edge.
So the two plies aren't glued together?
No.
Nope.
They're floating?
They
float.
Completely floating together.
Yep.
Are they spaced or are they touching?
Except on this, they are glued outside this ring.
Little pin there.
Are they spaced apart or are they touching?
They're
touching.
They're touching,
yep.
But they're still not.
Yeah, they're not fixed.
Not fixed.
This is the classic sort of 70s, rock. 80s studio rock drum sound. On toms.
Would you mic that from like a third of the way instead of right where he's hitting it, just for, out of
like
curiosity?
There.
Yeah. You hear that difference in pitch? Mm. That same principle applies to miking a bass. Oh, sorry, we're not talking about
bass.
How dare you?
We're getting there. We're getting there.
Come on.
And then the super big brother, which is used for snares a lot, is a Emperor X, which is a two plies really thick with a reverse dot underneath for more focus. This is like for heavy hitters, people that, want a thuddier sound.
Or have less technique.
Or have less technique. You're just like...
Is that to also give the drummer a target?
Sometimes I would suppose.
Another thing,
where to drool.
Yeah.
Another thing the dot in the middle does is add some mass to that fundamental mode.
Yep.
So you've got some more mass concentrated where that fundamental mode is vibrating mostly, and less mass where the higher order modes are vibrating more towards the edge.
Fucking mass.
Yeah. Is the dot another piece of material, or is it just color?
No, it's a
piece of material. Okay.
Stuck on there.
Okay. Yeah. Definitely adding mass.
A lot of people, when I get done, some dudes can just hit, like the bejesus
off.
It'll come back peeled off. I'll be like, okay, because these will take it. They'll take a 30-day tour of use for somebody. Oh. I mean, it's a durable head. That's why a lot of rock guys like them for tours. They have to change your snare head twice a tour. But yeah, it'll come back all peeled back. You're just like, dude, calm down. Just a little bit. And this is basically a kick drum head in some way. Well, we'll get to that. But it's a single ply head coated with this little ring on the inside that
is loose.
It's loose. So it acts as like a damper. Almost.
It's in a way, it's like a gate for the harmonics, because as you hit it, that flap moves but then settles back on the head and takes away some of the harmonics after the initial hit, which I'm not going to be hitting it hard enough to make that happen. But this head actually has a decent amount of sustain.
It's all the fundamental that you're that you're hearing.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to rattle because the thing was so loose around there.
Yeah, it shouldn't.
Well, and then the sort of the little brother of the Emperor X, which was a really thick one with an inner dot, is the controlled sound, which is just like a lot of companies. Evans has the Power Center reverse dot. Aquarian has one.
This is an Ambassador with a dot.
Yeah, an Ambassador, which is the single ply coated with a dot on the inside. Brighter than that, longer sustain.
Good attack in the center.
And another 70s goodness is the clear of this. This is when I think of Bonham.
Yeah.
So, because Bonham was a very much a clear. It's a little brighter, but still, it's got some bigness to it. So, yeah, that's just, I could have a stack of different drum heads.
Yeah, this is just one manufacturer.
Yeah.
And they make heads this many more different heads too, just in their professional line. So it gets quite complicated. Okay. So there's some different heads.
And they all sound and feel differently and take tuning a little bit differently based on the thickness of the head. And so you make these decisions on which ones to choose given the context in which you're going to use them.
And the drums that they're going to be put on.
Sure. Exactly. Some drums don't love two-ply heads. Some drums take them just fine.
We're going to have to reconsider our drummer chokes.
We're complicated.
Okay.
It's definitely complicated.
Other things? Questions? Before we move on? Are we done?
We're done.
Done with snares. Okay. Do we want to do kick?
Yes. Kick's fine.
I'm pretty sure I minimally dampened the...
Here, I will stand up and make room for this, too.
Yeah, I was going to just fold that up before I...
How does this fold up? I've got to beat on the seat part.
You can do it.
No,
you can.
I'm dropping my camera.
Oh, well, don't do that. No. Somebody smarter than me.
Look at that.
Hey, not bad for
so
a drummer.
Amazing.
Don't do it. All right.
Goodbye. Oh, here we go. Trying to get high.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, do we want to put the mic back in back here? Do we want to put it in front like you would mic it when you are...
Let's do, do that and then bring this down about the same distance. Yeah,
yeah, 39 inches from or something. Okay, so this at least has a hole in the front. I can tell that.
Yes, it does. We'll talk about that in a little bit.
Okay.
I basically just eat. There's a little bit of dampening in there. I evenly spaced it so that it's hitting both. And you can get into talking about that.
Well, we should... Actually, we should have it without anything in
there.
Do
we take it all out?
So you can
I can
hear
totally take it all out.
Yeah.
Out.
Yeah.
Basically, yeah, sorry.
We'll go full bottom.
Full bottom, yeah.
You never had any damping in this?
Not all the time. He would have felt strips on
the
head.
That's a very
We can talk about that.
Okay.
Because that's still common with a lot of jazz drummers who don't put anything in the bass drum. The bass drum is a big chamber that just wants to bounce sound around it. So in jazz, the bass drum typically has a much longer note to it. That they can get away with, but with still no damping at all, it you get this kind of basketball-y boing thing going on in the shell. So when did the felt thing start? Like bajillions of years ago.
Long, long time ago.
40s?
Early. They would take strips of felt, and with the hoop off and the head off, stretch the felt, put the head on, and then put the hoop on. So now the head is holding the felt, and the felt is lining the head behind it.
But invisible.
I remember when drums used to come that way.
Right.
They would come, you know, from the manufacturer if they had heads on them.
Yeah, so they'll do a felt strip on the front, usually a felt strip on the back, and that provides enough overtone damping to let the drum still be tuned up where they want it, but it's not so out of control that you can't do anything with
just
it in an ensemble.
Decay.
Yeah, yeah, shortens it up a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So then in rock world, like with the Beatles, Ringo at first was playing nothing in the kick drum, but he usually had a single-headed, there was no head on the front of the kick drum when they started recording. So then the engineers hated that. So they started putting things in there. And it was usually actually for a long time, it was the four-person sweater that they did the was it Help?
Oh yeah.
Okay, that wound up in Ringo's bass drum for years with a weight on it, you know, to keep it in one place. But without, so that it's got a decent amount of sustain.
Probably
Actually, not too bad. Both of these heads, this back head is a power stroke, so it's a single ply head, but it has that same sort of flap on the outside to help suppress some of those overtones. The front being ported there and then ported
all the way around it.
Around,
dries it out.
You've got escape for air. So all that air that would be normally bouncing around in the shell has a place to go. So even with nothing in there, it's a drier sound than if it were a solid front head and a undamped batter head at all. That then it would just be like sound like a concert bass drum. Now, I'm also...
So in case you can't see this front one, there's one port in it, and then there's a bunch of little holes around the perimeter. I've never seen that before.
This is a bass drum beater, and this is a two-sided one. So what you were hearing was this hard plastic side, and this is felt, which is still, it's dense and hard, but it's going to have a different sound. And the other thing is also where... you have the beater hit the head on the backside, because if you have it hitting dead center on the diameter of the drum, it's like hitting dead center on the snare. It's going to be shorter and darker and a faster note. As soon as you go off the center a little bit, everything starts opening up. So that's felt.
Do we want to do a thing? Do we want to do a
save?
Oh, a thing?
I don't know. Do you want to do a capture to see? I don't know. Up to you.
What are we going to compare?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, yeah. Probably thing to do would be to compare this, and then we'll throw the damping back in.
That's also
lovely.
And this is almost a foot away from the front head.
Yeah.
FYI.
Mm-hmm. Are you looking for the decay?
I think the decay would be interesting to look at for sure, but we can't do the capture.
Most of the decay is that front head resonating.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if you move that mic inside the drum, that
it'll shorten.
It's going to look a lot, yes, lot steeper.
That's a good hang on it.
That's pretty good.
Cool. So now we'll throw the pillow back in.
Do you want to do one just on... Do you want to slowly build it in?
Sure.
So we'll do one just on the batter side first.
So you see when you hit it, the frequency goes all the way up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting how much...
There's a lot in there.
...is in that, and also snares.
Yep, yep.
So when I do like de-essing, I do it all the way to the top, because if there's something there, I don't want to need the top each.
Right, right.
To pull down.
Yep. It'll be all right. Okay, so that's touching the back head, right?
Yep.
Okay, so now we have, it's a small, these are specifically, it's not like you're going to go take a nap on that.
Yeah.
They're made for kick drums. This is touching the back head lightly. Already that note is short compared to the other one.
And a lot less on the top octaves.
Yep. But we're starting to build up a lower fundamental that's stronger. Because a lot of that harmonic stuff is gone.
Oh, so you can capture that, Bob. Is that right?
Well, I can stop it on here, but I can't capture it the way I did the others.
Okay.
Sorry.
Can you do a screenshot?
I could do a screenshot, but how much do you want me to disrupt the flow here?
Not. Not.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right, sorry. So now the similar sized pillow touching the front head as well
as
the back.
Okay, start it running again. There you go.
Now we're getting into like studio kick drum territory.
Yeah.
Throw a mic inside there, it's going to get a lot of attack and this really good low fundamental. You know, that's a good sound of drum.
Yeah.
So he had a pillow to the front this time?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Touching the front, touching the back.
Is there Velcro inside?
There is.
Yeah.
Did you get, obviously.
Wasn't there a third one?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, what gets complicated, and Dan will attest to this, a lot of times when you're in a live studio or a live situation, people are going to want dampening in the front, dampening in the back, but a lot of times people want to put a condenser mic inside the kick drum, like a 91, so they need a place to lay it. So I have this, you just don't want to put it on raw wood, so I have this little like EQ pad that I just put in between so that they can put a 91 in there. And then they'll usually supplement it with something like a little fatter, like a 602 or a 52 or something like that.
The 91 is a little flat plate with the microphone in it that was originally made to sit on the floor and be a boundary layer mic, but they've been using it in drums a lot.
So that's why we put a little additional dampening in there, just so that the sound guy will have something to lay that on there, because I imagine they're not cheap mics.
One difference that is very, very obvious is in a lot of the live sound situations where they have 64 18-inch subwoofers, a bass drum that's quite a bit drier is a safe way to go from a drummer's perspective.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to say.
Rick?
So I want to talk about the 91s. Back in the 80s, we were using SM-91s, and then they were discontinued, and people were all upset about that. So they, as far as I know, they came out with a Beta 91.
Yeah.
Do you guys, there's any differences? Do people collect the SM-91s and just use those all the time to keep rebuilding them as long as they can? Or?
Yeah, I've had both. I use a Beta 91 all the time now because I think it sounds better. And it has an XLR, full-sized XLR jack on it.
And that's the best thing about it.
Because the original had the mini XLR and an external power pack.
Yeah, and a tiny little cable.
Yeah, a crappy little thin cable.
Very long.
Yeah.
Got in the way a lot. I use them interchangeably. They work the same for me.
Both sound great. And the convenience of being able to plug a real cable into the Beta 91 completely far outweighs if anything that the original sounds better or something.
If you have to tape the original to the bottom of a piano lid, it's lighter by a little, so it's, that's a little better. But
there.
In 57 and 58, they changed the pattern also for the Beta. They did that.
Oh, yeah. I think it is. I think it might be a hypercardioid, but I'm not sure of that.
The Beta 91 has a switch, like a mid-cut switch, which when you're putting it in a kick drum can be cool to get rid of a bit of the basketball-y if that's still in there. It just kind of gives it a little bit of a smiley curve so your lows and highs are a little more pronounced. I have one permanently mounted in a kick drum with a solid front head, so it's not moving anywhere. And I have an XLR jack on the side of the shell, and I just go, bleh, and it's done. And I can take it to a gig, and it's done. I can take it to a different studio, and it works great. Nobody's ever complained about the sound of it.
Could you show the difference between the soft side, like you've been using here, and the hard side?
Yeah, with it damped like this, it'll...
Yeah.
You'll hear it. Okay, so here's the felt.
Right. And then here's the plastic.
It's less pronounced on this kind of beater because the size of the felt and density of the felt on these is
pretty hard.
Pretty hard. I use a large round felt beater. And it's about that tall. This is surface area of the felt here is about that. So that tall, all the way around, and it makes any kick drum sound enormous. It's a completely different feel because there's a lot of mass, and a lot of people have they'll sit at my kit and be like, why?
So if you play softer with that, you think there's more contrast between that on that beater.
Falling. Trying to balance.
Totally, yeah. There's still a difference. That just
depends on the style again.
Yep.
Yeah.
Plus, he's also an important thing is that he plays off the head, which
right,
which I'm a staunch advocate for.
So here, That's if you play huge into difference. The head.
So he's hitting it and holding it.
Yep. Yeah. And a lot of people play like that. And
most people play like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, most people difference. Do.
So if you come off of it, listen to where the lows go and the length versus...
The pitch goes up.
Pitch goes way up. And the lows don't have a chance to develop.
Now, if you take the muffling out of the bass, that all of that contrast is dramatically increased.
Pull off the, particularly it'll sound way better. Just pull off the.
Pull them off the heads.
So where did you like to put the offset?
The which what?
Where do you like to dip the bass?
Oh, I prefer it off-center.
Like how far over?
It's not this way. It's this way because we're dealing with the height of the beater shaft.
Yeah.
So isn't that middle now? That's a little higher.
No, it's higher. Yeah.
Okay.
And I have an extra long beater shaft on mine, and I go to the very top.
Okay, so it's
weird.
It's still centered on the center line.
It's still here.
It has to be centered because that's how it mounts.
Does this have any play in it that you can make it higher or lower?
No. Sure. You can adjust the length of the beater. Off center, you're going to get more tone, more of the actual fundamental pitch.
Right. And
if you play into dead center, it's like putting your finger on the middle. You're going to be muting the fundamental pitch to a degree.
If you have a double pedal, so a bass drum pedal with two beaters, one's played with one foot and the other with the other, they're usually offset equidistant, so you're already off center, but then you've got height off center to go further. Okay, so that's open.
Open.
And I'm going to bury it.
You can hear the pitch.
Yeah.
Way to play a bass drum.
So this is a chain drive. Is that making any effect on the sound?
No.
Versus
no,
the other
it's just comfort. Feel.
It's comfort
yep.
and
yep.
the big direct drive. And
efficiency
drive
for the
and
drummer.
Marketing.
Yeah, another marketing thing, exactly.
It's good. I use chain drives. It feels good. I don't know what the physics are.
Okay. Yeah, I was playing a show once and they had a leather strap that broke.
Yeah, that's not good.
Right. Yeah. What happened to the kick?
So if you have a drummer come in the studio that doesn't have a hole in the bass drum, is that something you want to cut a hole in?
That's always a problem. Ooh. I mean, it's not necessarily a problem. I mean, what I do, you have to, you know, it's a lot of diplomacy. That goes on
and tears
and you know, sometimes it's just a matter of here's this, and then what I'll do is I'll put like a sweatshirt or something again, at least against her if it's not working. I mean, that's all subjective too. That may be the great sound. It depends on the arrangement. You know, when I play in a duo with my wife and it's acoustic guitar and drums, and I want an open, because I'm playing the bass sort of, and I play off the head and I play quiet, you know, and in that situation I don't want it that smack. And if that's what the recording session is leaning towards, then it's all good. But for like a rock or a pop kind of a thing, we'll just run, you know, record a minute and listen to it, and then put a pillow up against the front head just to sort of at least contain the that some of that resonance. And then they can usually tell that it cleans up the low end a little bit, because if it's competing with the bass, and also depends on the pitch, you know, of string bass or the tonality. But you just have to experiment. Cutting a hole in someone else's bass drum head is always a little risky. You know, here, let me just get my knife out. And you can also take the head off. You know, and then
the feel changes drastically.
Yeah,
so
you don't have
if
the,
they're used to playing. Some drummers are really. They're just like, yeah. What do you want me to do? How can I make this easy for you? And if you ask them to take the front head off, or cut a hole, or hey, I've got an extra head that already has a hole in it. Are you cool with that? Yeah, sure, whatever. Great. But then you, especially like younger or less experienced bands who haven't been in the studio a lot, but they've been rehearsing one particular way,
and they have suddenly their sound.
They've got right. a sound. They have a sound, but he's also got a feel that mm-hmm. suddenly you're saying, "Hey, I'm gonna really mess up your whole vibe here, but it'll be better for me." Don't yeah. do it. And then, like, I did a record in here. The drummer had a 24 or 26 inch bass drum. It was very big. So this is a 22 diameter. His was bigger. Solid front head. And I'd done a bunch of recordings with them before. I'm not going to change it. This is the sound of this band.
Right.
So I put the M49 in front of the drum off where I... And I'll have the drummer play, and I move my hand in front to find where I'm feeling the most amount of energy coming off of it. And that's where I put the mic. Then I dropped an SM7 over the back, pointing right at the beater. An SM7 is good because it's got a tight pattern. Its off-axis bleed is pretty minimal. But now I've got a mic that essentially is acting like my inside mic.
Yeah, your tack.
Yeah, so I'm getting my beater attack that I'm blending with this humongous bloom off the front. And he's not playing, like, 64th note death metal. He's not doing that. He's playing these open tones on his kick drum in a way, like, with the bass player. And it sounds great. Worked perfectly. So that kind of situation, you have to assess how much damage are you going to do to this player first, because it's their music, not yours.
And the performance.
And their performance.
Is absolutely the priority
yeah.
in getting the sounds to work. Is, you know, that's second, you know.
Point a 57 at the head back here. Point it off axis from the bottom of the snare. Whatever. Capture the sound. That's your job. And the job is to not mess up their vibe.
An SM7 is a side address microphone, so how do you get it?
It's a front address.
It's just like an end address?
Yeah.
Yeah. Really?
The SM7. Yeah. It's like a broadcast.
I saw people talk about... Okay.
Do you do the phase flip on when you're making bass drums?
If I needed to.
Oh.
Gotta,
not automatic.
Nah, got to listen. And again, I would be checking both of those against the overheads. Most of the time, one is going to get flipped from the other, just because when you're in this situation now, it's even different than if you have a mic in the drum and a mic in the front. They're at least both getting the sound coming this way. Now you've got one pointing and the sound's going there, and now you've got the front one, the sound's going there.
And a mic under the snare that's
exactly.
Like,
yeah.
The top, it's like,
yeah. So you do lots of listening in mono to every mic against every other mic before you hit record, and then you probably still change something. but yeah, it sometimes you do have to flip it, but do it before you record.
Question: is there different tuning techniques for a kick versus any other drums?
Sure. Yeah.
Same underlying principle when you first put the heads on. You try and get them even all the way around, and there's certain relationships between the front head and the batter head. It depends on how much muffling you're doing. The more muffling is in there, the less critical those are. It does make a difference having them the head put on evenly. And I've experimented with this. And you can experiment all the time. That's how we learn what we, that's how we cultivate our instincts. But sometimes it's just detune one lug if you're going for a sound, if you have time to mess with that, it's fun and it can sometimes be magical. But in general, I start with the drum in tune with itself for the same reason. The whole thing is going to vibrate as one instrument, even though it's got different components to shell and front head, back head. But it's what works in the end.
Right, because those other things are sort of in the moment, oh shit, I need to fix something kind of things. Like on a tom, a lot of times you'll hear a sympathetic resonance off the snare drum because tom's got a lot of note, a lot of sustain. You hit it and snares are going, but part of that is part of the sound you associate with a drum kit. Because if you turn the snares off and hit the tom, you're kind of like, where the hell did it go?
Yeah, what happened to high frequency?
Yeah, or even the kick drum will excite the snare drum. And if you hit the kick drum without a snare drum here rattling, it doesn't really sound like what you perceive a kick drum to sound like these days. Because you always hear kick with snare rattles and toms with snare rattles. But you can do things like take one lug near the snare on a tom and start backing off a little, and maybe it's a half a turn. Maybe you loosen the hell out of it. But now you've messed up some of that resonance on that head, so it stops being in sympathy with the snare tuning. And sometimes it's because your notes of those two are close but off enough where they're exciting each other. But those are things you do after you know you've already gotten them in tune with themselves and sounding good. Then you hit problem solving.
So sometimes when you tune a rack tom, for example, if it's going to be mounted, especially if it's mounted to the bass drum, you get it sounding all perfect and get just the right bend or whatever you're going for, and then you put that thing on the rack mount, and all of a sudden it's not working. You know, so then oftentimes it's just pick a lug.
Yep.
You do detune something because something about that gravitational pull on this is creating it's minimizing or affecting the resonance of some part of that drum. And you just kind of like just a quarter turn or an eighth of a turn. Sometimes it's even more dramatic, but just you can go around. All of a sudden, you find that sweet spot where the drum just kind of opens up and comes to life.
Here, Kelly. Kelly has a question back here.
Drag one of them back and in line with the other one, or do you just have this situation where one of them's canceling the other one out?
Drag it back physically, or drag it back like in Pro Tools?
Yeah.
Almost never.
And why wouldn't you?
Because that upsets the relationship of everything else. If I'm cutting,
but you're talking about a difference of like a foot and a half or 2 feet. And you're talking about frequencies that are like...
You mean like overhead to close mics kind of thing?
No, you're talking about putting a mic in front of the bass drum and you're putting a mic on the batter head.
Mm.
And then flipping the polarity. I'm just curious. There's a...
Right.
You're almost like
talking about frequencies that are below 100 cycles.
Sure.
And you're...
Time aligning.
Riff with cancellation.
Yep. And in those instances, a lot of times I use a plugin called Auto Align, which will look at both phase and distance and then snap it.
So does that time align both signals?
Yeah.
But those low frequency waves are so long that that's insignificant difference, that 2 feet or whatever it is, because they're 20 or 30 feet long.
It's going to affect the high frequencies.
Yeah, it's a high frequency phenomenon.
Yeah.
So that's when you need to dial in those delays or whatever. Well,
there's a lot of that in this business.
Yeah.
I particularly
with this instrument. There's so many philosophies.
It's such a big thing that just is. There's so many frequencies happening,
especially with the drum set.
It's like a dance, man.
Yeah.
You're just dancing, and you know, if you get that sound good, that sound good, and that sound good, what they just discussed, and something feels off, you just got to massage it a little bit, you know. And you'll find it. You know, you always will.
Rick? I just like to. I think it's important to remember that the drum set, it's like it's all one instrument, even though there's all these various components with different sounds and different harmonics. I like to approach it as though it's, you know, like you wouldn't, if you got this great violin and you wouldn't like time align a string or something to I don't know. I guess
or
anything
gaff
goes.
Tape it.
Never mind.
Rick, you had a question.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about polarity and phase. Are you finding that the microphones that you have available to you are kind of what's available out there? Do they come all in the same polarities, or is there disagreements between manufacturers or model numbers that which way, like when you have an incoming pulse, if the waveform is going to go down or going to go up? And the other question was about phase. Are some of the microphones, like tube microphones, are they so slow that they actually have enough delay on them that you have to worry about phase?
Not that I've ever had to deal with. And I use a lot of... I will combine tube mics with solid-state mics, with ribbons. Like, miking a drum kit for me is usually 20 to 25 mics. And of all different kinds. But it's those timing and phase differences that also give it depth. And I'm choosing those tools to do a certain thing. And if I were to go in and align stuff, one, I'd be losing all my depth, and the fun would go out of it for me really fast.
Yeah, when you're snapping everything to a grid, and it's like, cool, everything's at 120 BPM, completely set. Yeah, it just doesn't feel good.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that, I've not found that any particular manufacturer or something has decided that their positive or negative polarity is different from somebody else's. I've run into that with preamps occasionally, Vintec preamps. Their in-phase tends to be out of phase compared to other preamps. I don't know why.
I would think that vintage mics would have an issue that were made when their pin 3 was hot.
Right, well, that's
now
that's just a physical thing that hopefully you know that it's just wired there opposite from... but, I don't know, I've got some mics from the 60s. AKGs and stuff that seemed to be okay. But again, I just listen every time, and if something is in or out of polarity with something else, we'll fix it.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm not smart enough to kind of go in and look at all the... How fast is this responding? And I just want to make a record.
Any other bass or kick drum things?
Well, of your 25 microphones, so uh-huh. That was quite impressive. How many are on the drum, the drum components versus the cymbals?
Versus rooms and stuff. Well, cymbals, I don't spot mic cymbals unless it's like ride and hi-hat. If I feel like I need a ride mic, usually I don't. A lot of times I don't need a hi-hat mic because that's the loudest thing they hit. So generally a pair of overheads, sometimes a center mic, and that center mic might get destroyed in some fun fashion with lots of compression and distortion. But because it's centered, it's kind of seeing kick and snare equally rather than spread out. 2 to 3 mics on the kick, 2 to 3 mics on the snare, hat, ride, 1 mic on the toms. Sometimes if somebody's got just a rack and a floor, I might double mic the tom, do top and bottom, and I'll bus them usually to one track.
1 mic on each tom, or 1 mic on the
each head. Each head. So okay. Top and bottom on the rack tom, top and bottom on the floor tom, or something like a sub kick style mic on the bottom of the floor tom, just something else. Usually at least 1, sometimes 4 or 5 kind of wild card mics. I do a crotch mic a lot of times called because it's sort of pointing right here at the drummer's crotch. And
is that extra percussion?
Hey-o. And that could be an 87 in Omni that's getting smashed by an 1176 and is really just all of a sudden it's this whole picture of the drum kit kind of from where the drummer is sitting. It could be an old AKG D19 dynamic that just gets weird, crunchy sounds. It could be a Green Bullet harmonica mic. I've got a bunch of old cassette deck mics that I've wired up with XLRs, and I spread those around the kit. It could be a 57. It could be whatever. And then I start going room mics, and I could have a room mic sort of behind the drummer. Ribbons are good for that. Because they're bidirectional, so they're picking up reflections from behind the drummer, and they're getting this. Then I start going out and usually have a close set of rooms, sometimes something on the floor, medium rooms, and then depending on where I am, like if I'm tracking at Litho, a lot of times I leave the door to the basement open, and I put something in there.
Did you get that?
you know.
Is that all?
Maybe.
Then he has one in the upstairs.
I don't know.
Litho in the refrigerator.
I've done. Yeah, I've done upstairs in the balcony.
For PA gigs, I have 5 to 7 microphones.
Mics to the wall.
Most of the time.
I like options. I don't use them all the time, but I like...
I don't have 30 inputs for the drums.
Oh,
I want to move on here.
Okay.
Yes.
Are we done with bass drums? Any other further questions on that? Okay, let's do hi-hat.
Oh, we moved
it? I just throw it out.
Yeah, apparently we need to just throw it out.
Let me put these back in and then I'll
okay.
get moving on this.
So we have hi-hat, toms, and cymbals.
Hi-hat should take about 3 minutes.
Don't hit them so hard. Please.
Well, you know what we could do, Dan? We could do a hi-hat and cymbals at the same time.
We could.
Because it'll just be, because, you know, that'll be sort of get it all square.
Okay. These, we met once and came up with these categories and times. So that's where that came from, just so that you know.
How are we on schedule?
It's still Tuesday or Wednesday.
There's a schedule somewhere.
I think we're doing good.
Right. It's Thursday.
Here.
Yep. Is today Thursday?
Cool.
I'm tired.
Should the hole in the base in the front head, does it make a lot of difference as to where you put it?
Yep. Absolutely.
I was going to say, yeah.
If it's in the center, like dead center, which is where Yamaha used to put them all the time, never understood this, it's just everything's going out of there. And it can be this big, it can be this big. It's letting a whole lot of that drum out. If you go off center, now at least where the blast from the beater is hitting, you've got a solid area that can resonate some while still venting. So, yeah, big thing.
Good question. And does it matter which quadrant of the drum you put it in?
No, but I find that depending on where it is, and then when you're putting a mic in there, you can point away from the snare drum more easily. Hmm. So if it's looking out, if it's on this side, and it's a right-handed drummer, and the snare drum's over here, and the hole is over here, now I'm coming in, if I want to point towards the beater, I'm also pointing at the bottom of the snare. Right. So I tend to like holes on this side, and not all the way at the bottom, because that's a pain in the butt for certain mics trying to get in there. So, like, 2 o'clock, then you can come in this way, point away from the snare, and still have maneuverability, because sometimes you want that mic a little off-axis. Mm-hmm. If it's pointing dead at the beater, this is all you're getting. You want some shell.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
The evil hi-hat.
The evil hi-hat. Should I
say
I'm
going to
start you out with shimmery. Then. Let's make it real shimmery.
Because they come that way. I cut my own. And I cut them very small. I cut it as small as I can to allow a mic in there. So that it's as much a solid front head as possible. And, like, on my kick drum, there is no hole. It's a solid front head, and the mic's inside.
Do you just cut
it with a box cutter or something?
I have a tool for cutting bass drum head mic, or holes.
So you get a nice circle.
It's a perfect circle, yeah, and you can adjust the size. It's real handy.
Do you know my... the drummer in my first band he used to take a coffee can.
Heat up a coffee can.
And then he would just
melt it through.
Right on the middle. Yeah. Made a perfect circle. We thought he was so innovative when he did that. He was like, check this out. That was just so amazing.
Yeah, you want those on.
Especially him right now.
Yeah.
Steve, you should play.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have one of my sticks?
Do we got any stools?
The kind of stick really makes a difference.
There's a couple in the back.
Did you bring any?
Oh, yeah, of course you did.
Okay.
I brought all that good stuff.
Can you move that connector so it's
already passed
over
to you? Mm-hmm. Thanks. Hey, and do you want to just put these on? I really think this will be a good example of differences.
Here they are. Steve, I have this stick. It was in my pocket.
Okay.
Keeping it warm for you.
Thanks.
Yep.
All right, so we'll start with hi-hats.
And I have these, too.
Yeah, okay.
That's a hi-hat.
This one is a small diameter.
14. These are 14s. These are standard. The most common. So this is a maple. It's not, the difference is masked a little bit because you have so much actual sizzle after they hit. Hit the shoulder, obviously you get a longer, deeper sound. Over the top, shorter and softer. The biggest problem you can encounter recording younger bands is they're going to play like that all the time, and they're going to play three times as hard as that.
At least.
I don't know what. I mean, don't hit the hi-hat so hard. That's what I say. But in a gentle way. Yeah, but it feels good. It's like, yeah, I get it. It's that energy thing. And once again, it's the, take 10% off the top attempt, at least. Here's a 5/8 hickory. You can hear a little bit of it. It's just heavier, mostly. And then if you can talk the drummer into using lighter sticks, that might help with the hi-hat being out of control. There's your 2B. The maple. I use maple because I like the feel. When we get to the ride cymbals, it'll be much more apparent. Let's see if you can tell the difference between thumb on top. You have to hear this, and I'm sort of cupping the stick, so I'm getting the. Can you hear this? Versus this? Versus. Okay, that contrast will translate to your cymbal sound as well. It's subtle, but kind of not. I mean, once you learn to recognize it, it can be very, very dramatic. We'll try it like this. You can hear a lot more attack this way. So I'm still holding it super loose. It's this. It's a little bit washier. I don't know if you can hear that. It's obvious to me. Right cymbal, it makes even a bigger difference.
I have right
cymbals. We'll get those out.
Yeah.
Crashing, most common advice is don't hit them so hard. You don't need to. It's like, think of your cymbals as like your tweeter. It's like you got the, you got your sub, and then you got your little tweeter. It's like this, the drum set is one instrument, and it should be balanced like a pyramid, where you have the lower the frequencies, the bigger the amplitude. The higher the frequencies, the lower the amplitude, all the way from the bass drum all the way up to the top end. And that's all you need to do. I'm not going to hit it too hard. That would be cruel. Okay, but I hear these people, and then
but also
and then sometimes
glancing blows. On.
Yeah, you can do that. Mostly, I just let go of the stick, and depending on where I'm coming from, if I'm over here and I'm hitting a cymbal over there, there's going to be an arc. You almost always there's going to be a bit of an arc, which is where
so
that
you
term,
don't fold your cymbal.
You don't
in
fold
half.
Them. Yeah, yeah.
If you find a guy breaking cymbals, it's because he's
hitting them too hard.
Off.
He's coming straight down on it, and
they're choking the stick. Listen to this. Versus, I bet we could really see this. I mean, what you're doing is you're also pushing it in, and you're going to choke that cymbal when it recoils and comes up against the felt.
Which is another little thing. Like a lot of jazz guys, you'll see they immediately, if I'm saying a kid,
loosen it up.
They immediately walk in
or take it off.
Yeah. A lot of rock dudes will come in immediately. and then they'll choke it as tight as possible. So it's like as tight as possible. And then they wonder why they spend like $5,000 on cymbals a year.
Yeah. And I used to break a 16-inch crash cymbal every 2 months. $130, I leave the price tag on. That's what they cost in 1975. And it was because I hit too hard. I held my sticks too tight. Mm-hmm. I also sucked. I played, you know, it's like, you know, my sense of time was, okay, when you go to the fill, speed up. Anyway, the time and the feel and the relaxation all relate to the performance. And, it, you know, feel has to do, maybe I'm on a tangent, but it's like, how am I feeling when I'm playing it? If I'm feeling all of this motion, I think that the motion of the sticks is like a wave, basically. There's frequencies and there's things that happen here. You know, that's a 2-to-1 ratio, how fast this happened. If you can talk a drum into relaxing more, those things will naturally come into focus. It takes practice, but even the slightest a bit of just calming down will help the performance and timing, and not to mention the tone. What happens when you break a cymbal? You hold the stick too tight, hit super hard, you dent it. That's what what precedes a crack is a dent in the cymbal. Once that dent's there, it's only a matter of time, no matter what your technique.
And that's why some drummers don't let other people play their cymbals.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I have
because
I have
the breakage.
We have people that want to come in and practice. I go, are you a hard hitter? You know, because a lot of people are like, yeah, I'm a hard hitter. I go, you have to bring your own cymbals.
Yeah.
You know, I can replace. Our heads get worn out, but dents in the heads. The same thing. If someone comes in, their heads are all dented up. I can tell you immediately that they're holding their sticks too tight. They're doing that. You know, they're literally. Sorry.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. I mean, that's literally what is happening. Or you know, here's another blast from my past. Hey, dude, let me see your calluses. You know, it's like. The one right here was a, you know, I'm left-handed, so I play my snare here, and dude, look at that. You know, of course, my hands used to be completely calloused and cracked and bleeding. You know, I wear white pants so I could brag about all the blood, you know. You know, plus I was so out of control. It's like I've got permanent scars here from catching the, you know, it's like, Ron, loosen up.
So you played for Iggy Pop, huh?
Yeah. And I mentioned this briefly earlier, but... Man, if you're trying to track it, in particular a younger, any player of any age, man, you try and talk them into playing the song. Put on a metronome and slow the tempo down 10 or 20%. I mean, the slower the better. Every aspect of their performance is going to improve. They naturally are going to kind of not hit as hard because they're focusing on trying to not rush everything. And everybody does this. Guitar players, you name it. I get the whole band to do this when I work with bands, or when we're doing pre-production for a recording, or if we're just recording. It's much easier to take 10 minutes and torture people, even if it's just one part of the song, you know. Or in particular, if it's a treble spot, 10 minutes, make them do it, and just like, okay, let's slow it down a little bit more. And by the time they're done, they're like. Yeah, because it's exhausting. And they go back, unbelievable results. And the drummer is starting to feel the time, the distance between each note is much more vivid. Guitar players are much more aware of where their hand is, when, in relationship to the rhythmic phrasing. you should try it if you haven't worked at a hook. You know, some people, they don't have to deal with that. I deal with it every day. All right, anyway, so... There. Cymbals. Don't hit them so friggin' hard.
So I got to ask Dave, you guys SIR rent cymbals. How many? Yeah. How much do you get broken?
Okay, you know how he's like, I don't want you to use my cymbals because I'm a really heavy hitter.
Yeah.
I will have guys walk in and actually say, I'm probably going to break one.
Oh.
And I'm just like, sweet. Just a check out, man.
Yeah.
I don't care if you break it. I mean, I have a wall of cymbals at work. You know, and
cost
this
of doing
is
business.
This is like, you know, a $350 cymbal. So it's sort of written into the cost, but not really. If I know that someone's being abusive, and there's a huge artist in this town that I rent backline to all the time, he orders 4 18-inch crash cymbals, and that's it. Because if they're not for percussion, it's not for a drummer. They just want to do this with it.
Right.
And the last tour they came back, there were 3 of those three of those four broken. Oh. I just called the TM and said, I have three broken symbols. He's like, cool, how much? Set it away. Some people just, I guess, just don't care, you know, and that's fine, but it happens often.
Okay.
But then you get a lot of jazz guys that are just careful.
Okay? Yeah.
They want to just be cool. They're you get rock guys that are like great technique. They're just like
cool. Smooth,
all
fluid.
The rest just doesn't matter. You know, they're punk rock dudes the same way. Then you get like maybe some weird dude who just has pitted his entire heads up after 10 minutes and he's broken two cymbals and he's angry at the world and you're like, dude, you play in an Americana band. You need to seek therapy, not a cymbal manufacturer.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to vent, quote, this was my you know, rationalization for my approach. I was an angry child, right? And I was also like I was into martial arts and I believe it or not, I used to bench 290. Mm-hmm. I was a fanatic. And I just thought that I, you know, the harder I played and the more exhausted I was after the end of a four-hour gig, the cooler
awesome.
I must be. Mm-hmm. You know, look at how soaked I am. I'm probably pale, you know. And I'm like, cool. And that's how I would, quote, vent my frustrations. I would burn them out of my body, right? It is a completely different. I sit down and I'm like joyful. No, that is feeling. That is playing with feel. It's like, well, how do I feel? I feel joyful. I feel relaxed. I feel in the most command I feel at any part of my life is when I'm sitting down behind a drum set. That's feel. And what happens is that's how they feel when they listen to someone play who has that kind of intention, you know, instead of like, you know, kill, crush, kill, destroy. I don't think anybody remembers Lost in Space, but
go ahead, and then I want to ask a question.
About cymbals and stick size. The smaller and lighter the cymbals, typically the lighter sticks are going to work better. If you're using, you know, 20-inch crash cymbals, you almost, my opinion, you kind of need to have a little bit of a heavier of a stick. Just you know, there you're meeting two you know, different mass instruments, and there needs to be a bit of a balance. If you try and hit a super heavy 20-inch crash cymbal with a very, very light, and I go for light sticks so I can swing them fast without getting too loud. But if you do that, it's hard to get the maximum efficiency out of that cymbal. But smaller cymbals, like this is pretty light. I mean, both these are fine for this kind of a stick. If they're... Yeah, see, that's already starting to sound forced to me. That crash versus... I don't know if you can tell a bit, but I feel the difference.
The one thing that's probably... These are two 17-inch cymbals. They sound totally different. Because this is brilliant finished. This is a dull, traditional finish. And the alloy compositions are different. This is darker. This is bright. So I wanted to put them up just as an example. So if you see something in the Zildjian K or like in Sabian AAX dark, anytime you see dark, you're going to get that warmer tone, and you can adjust accordingly in your recording. So,
what are these cymbals with all the little rivets and junk on them? Not these.
The dark.
Oh, yeah.
Ones with rivets.
Ones with rivets. And
sizzles.
Yeah.
It's more of a jazz thing. Yeah. It's just to sustain a white noise, basically.
Okay.
Brushes. You hit it with brushes.
Yeah.
It's an effect.
It's an effect. Okay.
Yeah.
So in terms of capturing them, it's kind of interesting seeing different sessions. I mean, a lot of people either label it overheads, but then it'll be either crash and ride because there are less overheads of the kit and more just cymbal lines. So the question is, I guess, your opinion on capturing that within a kit, and I guess that also depends on the style of music you're recording. But
that's
I guess in terms of like straight over it, so that you're getting straight off the center of it, off to the side, kind of, I guess, your mentality in terms of how you capture the different aspects of the symbol.
I have a limited approach to that. Don's got way more experience with that. I try and get, when I'm recording drums, and I'm always in a hurry because I work with people with that are very much on a budget, I try and get the two overheads and the bass drum to generate a really great drum sound. And sometimes, you know, what I end up doing is, and you don't have the tom or the floor tom image as much, but I don't worry about that as much. I can you know, spin the knob enough to get a little bit left side, right side, rack, floor, but I just... two nights ago, I put my, like on my hi-hats, like right here, I put one overhead over here, and I measured the distance from the snare and put the other overhead up here. And I'm doing some simple parts. I think I hit the toms three times so that I get that image, you know, snare center. Not that that has to be perfectly in the center, but I don't want any phase issues with those two overheads. And it sounds perfect. It's totally natural. I barely put the toms up in the mix at all. I used a little bit of the snare to get a little bit more of the lower frequency to blend in with it. But it was with that, you know, old 55 snare, so there's not a whole lot other than just bringing the levels up. And then sometimes I'll use, you know, a spot mic on the ride. I'll do the XY. I did that for years for the same reason, trying to get, you know, the snare for me is usually just a tiny bit off center, which I don't worry about it.
Which part of my the snare do you put the mic over?
Which part?
Well, I'm sorry, of the cymbal.
Which part of the cymbal?
You know what? I don't worry about that much.
Yeah.
I don't worry about it. If it's anywhere, if I want to, I don't worry about it.
You don't
like,
close mic.
I get plenty of. I mean, you can hear that. Listen to this. If it sounds good, I start recording.
Yeah.
My job in my sessions, he's got a different story, I'm sure, but my job is to get the people set up and happy and recording as fast as possible.
Yeah.
And if I use like six or seven, sometimes eight mics, I don't have to deal with a bunch of phase issues the way Don does, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if...
Mute.
Yeah, exactly. No, I don't. I it's a different thing. He's mm-hmm. like he makes his living recording records and mm-hmm. and does awesome at it. I make my living capturing live performances for the most part of bands, and we'll do overdub vocals,
mm-hmm.
and that's my game. And it means the fewer mics I use, the fewer issues I'm going to have. If I can capture great drum sound, half the time they're my students anyway, and they know how to play.
Yeah.
You know, they've been coached. They you know, and if it's a matter of just getting everything to sound balanced and real. I mean, that's what I go for. I go for a real, natural drum sound, and I can tweak the EQ. You know, more than anything, I end up rolling off the low end off my closed tom mics. Mm-hmm. Just to make room for the, you know, the acoustic guitar or the bass, whatever.
What about miking the hi-hat?
For years I didn't do that because I balanced, you know, most of the recording I've done has been myself. And mm-hmm. I balanced the kit. And if I'm using the XY right here, I've got everything that I want. And I'll put the mic sometimes right here to where it's as close to my mm-hmm. to my ears as possible. And I create the balance between all of these notes on my kit. If I do mic the hi-hat, which I do now, especially for other people, and like I say, I didn't used to. Now I'm kind of, I like it. I can always get rid of it, but I'll put it like right here,
mm-hmm.
or over here.
If you're the drummer.
If I'm the drummer.
If you're sitting at the drummer's seat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I put it over here usually and angle a little bit away from the
for snare. A righty. Yeah, mm-hmm. same thing. And angling away from the snare, I try and get some isolation. But mm-hmm. you know, I don't worry that much about the isolation when there's someone playing with control, mm-hmm. because it's like trying to isolate the E string from the B string on a guitar. In my opinion, it's all one instrument. As long as I have some control and there's no phasing issues,
mm-hmm.
and that little bit of control has come in really handy lately. Being able to finesse that hi-hat, just, you know, stuff that if I could do, I'd probably go back 20 years and add a hi-hat mic to everything.
Anybody else have any hi-hat miking things? Brian and Bill?
I've noticed on some 70s like recordings that I hear what sounds like phasing in the cymbals, and I don't know if it's because they put a phase shifter on it, mm-hmm. or whether the cymbal was just rocking back and forth.
That'll happen. And the mic sometimes it's just...
Yeah.
Especially if the overheads are too close.
Too close to the symbols.
Yeah. And where they are in relation to the edge of the symbol versus the bell, you will hear that.
Because there's so much variance. The distance is changing.
Yeah, exactly.
Like a lot of play on
that. Yeah. My overheads are usually... It depends. But they're up quite a ways, or... it's all about finding a good sound and then trying to make it a little bit better and then moving on.
Okay, and speaking of moving on, that was 20 minutes for this hi-hat and cymbals, but I want to hear Bill's question.
Before we move on real quick, let's hear the difference between the top and bottom side of the hi-hat.
One is the top hi-hat is thinner than the bottom. I just wanted to let them know because they didn't know that.
Okay. Yeah. Bill?
When you guys mix a drum kit and you're like staring at the speakers, is it always like you're looking at the drummer, the hi-hat is always over there, the four tom is always over there? Do you ever mix it from a drummer's perspective?
No. Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, no to your first question because sometimes when I wire the two overheads up, they're backwards. Because I'm in a hurry. It's either. We did a thing at London Bridge and Jonathan, because I was set up left-handed, he had everything ready to go right-handed. Mm-hmm. So we went audience perspective on that. And it was all live. We didn't care. Mostly, I do drummer's perspective. What do you do?
What about you?
I have to. Otherwise, my head.
Otherwise, I'm used to playing right-handed when I teach and left-handed when I play. So I'm messed up all the time anyway. It doesn't matter.
No, I default to drummers, but I will also ask
if they have a preference.
The band and the client. If I'm mixing like a live DVD, then I'm doing it audience perspective because the impression is supposed to be stage. But me as a drummer, how I hear drums. Kind of left to right is hi-hat goes over here, right over here.
And when I do screw up and I'm listening, I'm always thankful and grateful that I catch it. There's been times that I've gotten pretty deep into the mix and then if the drums sound good, I don't go through and solo everything. I just start, I need to get done. And then I realize, oh crap, this rack tom is over here and the hi-hat, I'm like going, or it's with a client, they go, hopefully they won't notice.
Does a left-handed drummer drive you insane then?
Yes.
No. Like I was going to say, because you're like, when I'm mixing, I'm used to hearing it a specific way, so does that immediately trip you out?
If I know it's a left-handed drummer, I will... I will do their drummer perspective.
Yeah, of course, but I'm just saying for a moment.
It does mess my head up.
Yeah, because you're just like, wait, is this audience perspective? Is this drummer perspective? Yeah.
Well, in a PA situation, you do an audience perspective.
For sure.
For sure.
I actually prefer it as a listener, because I've seen some audience perspective. I always love audience perspective. And I've always mixed our records as audience perspective, too. But
you're wrong.
I am totally wrong. I know it.
Okay, Tom's. Moving on to Tom's.
Didn't we do Tom's? One more thing we got to do is the bell. Right?
Yeah,
nobody hit the bell.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There you go.
So the bell has more curvature and is stiffer, and you get that higher, clearer note out of the bell.
I have common advice. Okay. Don't hit the bell so friggin' hard. Okay? That's the worst. No, it's not the worst. The hi-hat, no.
Hi-hat's worse.
The hi-hat's worse because it happens a lot more often. But, yeah, man, the drummer goes to the bell. And that cuts. That cuts so deeply, Just, I don't usually even play like that anymore.
May as well be a cowbell.
Yeah, exactly. I usually play... I use a tip because I don't want to have to reach that far because I'm old and lazy. But
I do plenty of bell.
I use a tip on a bell, so that's my bell opinion.
And it's usually the
wrapping up the cymbals.
Bye, cymbals.
Any questions while we're doing this? Any comments?
What about drummers that use cymbals that are
three beats away from completely disassociated.
Yeah, or completely cracked.
Sometimes that can be cool. I mean, there's no such thing as a bad sounding cymbal. There's just the wrong application.
Right.
I mean, I've used broken cymbals. When I used to have broken cymbals, I'd flip it upside down and turn it into a china. Sometimes you get the coolest sound. I mean, I think Bill Bruford used to do that.
Or you take them off, you throw them on the floor,
Tom, snap them. Or you put you piggyback them.
That's the new hotness. Is like taking an ozone which has holes in it, or EFX, stacking on another thing, and really trying to figure it. So it just goes.
It's the new China symbol.
It's totally the new China symbol.
But yeah,
how do these work?
I put a rivet in it, and I put it upside down. I use it as my alternate ride. When I would play, which is kind of cool. It's just
why can't I do?
Yeah,
this?
Whatever. I'm usually tentative about loaning them my good symbols.
Oh, wow.
If they bring in a bunch of, if they bring a bunch of broken cymbals, that's probably what they want to record with. And same thing applies to their kit. If somebody brings in you can offer let them use your kit, which I do often. But sometimes, if it's a kid in particular, or for someone an adult that doesn't have a lot of experience, they're still going to be more comfortable on their crappy kit than on my $4,000, custom made maple, and. That's why it's important to figure out how to make those drums sound. Get them to sing a bit, and the best way to do that is to just practice. Go out and buy a drum set, everybody. But that's how you do it. It turns into instinct.
You mentioned earlier on the hi hats how the bottom one was lighter or thinner.
But heavier.
Heavier.
Yeah.
Is that the same with all hi hats?
No.
I screwed up my daughter's kit.
No, not necessarily. I mean, that's sort of a craze that started back with the K Z combination. I think.
Well, even Newbeats.
The K Z's were more. I think
pronounced.
They were even heavier,
yeah. Well,
more contrast.
The Z was super heavy.
But I have these old '60s Peisty 602s. You can't really tell. They sound really silky and satiny. Doesn't matter if they sound good, whatever. I'll take a crash cymbal and put on top of another crash cymbal and sometimes come up with a really cool sound. Yeah. Hi-hats are a very, very interesting and colorful part of the sound of the kit. It's in everything for the most part. It's always there. So it's good to find something that works. And once again, it's the context, And don't hit it so hard.
The new hotness as well, which is the old hotness, because the old hotness always turns into the new hotness. It's
marketing.
It's like Cosmo from from CCR. He uses two 18-inch crash cymbals for his hi-hats. He has for 50 years or whatever. But that's starting to get a resurgence. I see a lot of people just using two 16-inch crashes, one mm-hmm. thinner, one thicker, and using them as hi-hats. And man, I think 14s are hard to deal with. It starts getting bigger, and it's just louder and louder and louder.
Yeah. Okay, Toms.
Yeah.
What is there to say? There's different sizes, different diameters, different depths.
Yep. Loudly like every other drum.
We've already covered a lot of it.
We didn't. We haven't had a floor tom out here.
Boom.
It will go forever. Unless you do this.
Take a leg off? Okay. Well, that's a cool trick. I hope it works.
I didn't know that trick at all.
Cool, Don.
Wow.
And now you can shorten it more.
And why is this?
Because that just...
These are made to resonate with the bend, and they're essentially like ISO mounts for the floor tom. Huh. So you get rid of that.
I had no idea. My mind just got blown.
Yeah, that's cool.
See, that's what I love about this.
Right
I'm
on,
like,
dude.
Yeah. I am so excited right now. Life just got exciting again.
I mean, this is sort of like when they had the mounted tom hanging way off the end. Well, now you're just pushing it all the way up to the stem of the hardware.
See? Now it sounds like a Ramones floor tom.
Exactly.
Plus, there's no rubber feet to also help cushion
right.
to decouple it from the floor.
Yep. Basically, everything that
So one thing to try, if you're in a situation where the floor tom sounds too resonant, and you start taping up the head, and that just, that kind of kills it. I mean, that's no, is there a gaff around?
I have some somewhere.
Here.
Oh, really?
Sweet. I had
Don.
Some
no, don't
no,
ruin
no,
that.
No, that's no, magical.
There we go.
Steal it. It's fine.
Oh, okay.
Please, hold my gaff.
You can tear it all the pieces.
Cool. So, you know, the normal thing that you do when something's ringing too much is you do
little loopy loop.
The loops.
Hey, Lincoln, can you zoom in on that?
And then it starts.
Have you ever tried taping, like, that's like this?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. Cool.
They're all similar different thing. It's just you're just sort of trying to grab some of the extra harmonics.
But you know, we could put the legs back, and like you heard the short floor tom, and it was cool. It still had tone, but it didn't go on forever. But it still sounded like, hey, you got a loose,
is it loose?
Bracket.
Okay, thank
inside.
You. Okay, thank you.
Put this back so that
you want to do this one too, Don?
Yeah.
So, and it actually, sorry, now I'm just, because I'm kind of, that was a pretty cool trick. And it obviously, it started decaying in certain degrees, too. So if you're running into some trouble, you could just do one, and then like, cool, that
right.
killed my, the whatever I needed.
So we're going to go back to full sustain, and none of this. So it goes on and on and on. But taping, sometimes just, it does weird stuff. Like, now there's this, like, other buzz in there that wasn't there. Oh, crap. So now I've got to put more tape on.
Now you're playing an indie rock band.
I'm like, oh, crap. And I just want it shorter. Flip the legs around. Done.
That's great. Thank you.
Done. And it still feels good and everything.
Now, you mentioned earlier about loosening one of the lugs to solve
right,
a problem.
Right, if you have all that sympathetic resonance on a snare.
Is that a real subtle effect for that purpose, or would you hear it if you loosened a lug?
I have to find the key again.
Those are 70 count, by the way, so you're going to have to...
Yeah, I know.
I was like, those are the...
They're the things that I hate.
What are you speaking here?
Okay, so DW, a year
fine
and a half ago...
thread.
They've always had fine threads. They usually had 50 count. These are now 70. So
50 per inch?
So yeah.
Okay.
So it said that these are 70 now. So mm-hmm. you can sit there with a screw gun and just be there for a while.
So if you're on tour in Topeka
yeah.
and you lose a tension rod, you can't usually go into a music store and get some extra tension rods.
Cody Willis from the Melvins called me before they played Bumbershoot. He's like, do you have any new tension rods? I just broke a turret. And I was like, luckily I just got this drum kit. And yes, I do have one.
So, yeah, just doing that, that's just going to make it start sounding bad.
Cool.
But,
yeah,
it could be fun, but
yeah.
It was more about the thing, like, where you have the sympathetic
right.
buzz off the snare drum.
Yep.
But again, that's where you're starting to get into problem-solving mode.
Right.
Not... let's make the best sounding rack tom.
Right. Okay.
So yeah, toms. You can mic them on the top. You can mic them top and bottom. You can mic them only on the bottom.
So we've got the resonance. Why are we not taping the bottom?
Guys do that.
You can do that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sounds bad, but
yeah,
you can do it.
It makes you wonder why people. Like, you know, it's kind of like the going deeper for a bigger sound when you should be going wider. You know, we were talking about it earlier. He's like, oh, I'm glad you brought standard depth toms.
8x12. So it's 8 inches deep, 12 inches in diameter.
Yeah.
Opposed to a power tom.
Which is 12x12. And that just, that creates a whole bunch of other issues, which probably is something for you to talk about, like the issues that might...
Where you're square-sized.
Yeah, square-sized.
Like a square room.
Yeah, big deep toms, man.
Boo.
Yeah, it's going to play with, again, how the batter head interacts with the resonant head. You have that bigger air cavity. A bigger air cavity is, an air cavity is almost like a spring. So, and a bigger air cavity is a less stiff spring. So it's going to play with that. There's also the size of the drum is, again, going to affect the height of those peaks. So the bigger drum you have, again, bigger is lower. It's going to emphasize the lower end peaks more than the higher end peaks. So
those deeper drums seem to be a little trickier to tune, the power toms for me. Mm-hmm. And I think it's more about marketing. Hey, everybody's got power toms. Ooh, let's make somebody swear that the standard depths are super cool. So then they market the hell out of that, and everybody has to dump their power tom kit and get their standard. Yeah, these are easy to tune. And then the market's saturated, and the drum companies need to sell more gear. So then they power tom, they get some endorser. And then that's just a theory, though. They wouldn't do that.
Question over there.
Going to concert tom era again.
You wouldn't.
It would be a very, very different sound.
Yeah.
It's not going to have the same. There's a lot of depth because of the two heads,
the interplay
vibrating in sympathy. It would be a much shorter, less deep tone without the bottom head. Now, the angle and the height of a floor tom in relation to the floor under it is a factor. So if somebody sits really low, like this is about where I normally sit, so this is actually sitting way lower than I would have it. So I would be raising it up, getting it further away from the floor. But if somebody sits really low and their floor tom is down here, it's going to interact and couple with the floor a lot more seriously than up where I am. It's already shorter.
And I said a guy's drum kit up who played about that low. I could not get to, he was
five?
His knees, he was pretty tall too, and his knees were up at his,
up like this.
Yeah, and he was just like, oh no, I gotta play really low.
So he's just doing it all wrong.
Oh, okay, man.
He's so much time in here.
He was real flashy. Wasn't really worried about playing well.
Mm.
It was mostly,
but it looked good.
Did he do this?
Oh, he was like the whole time throwing him up in the air.
It's important.
Do you teach that, Steve? Do you teach that at your school?
Do I teach failure?
No, what you're doing right now.
Very special school.
Yeah, somebody wants to learn to do it this great.
Yeah.
I can teach them how to do that.
There it is.
Okay, Don's awesome. Wow.
It'll change it.
Pitch should bend a little bit more in theory.
So see, now that I raised it back up, now it goes forever.
So now you're going concentric. I
want to get
rather than diagonal.
Because I'm lazy.
Okay.
It's harder on the bottom.
Yeah, I would say, especially when you're sitting in where he's sitting on the kit.
Teamwork.
Yeah, that's a go team.
All right, so this is about a quarter turn on each lug, and since they're 470 count per thing, it really didn't go anywhere.
Break it up.
Still going.
Yeah, so again, the top and the bottom head at that fundamental mode are really coupled together really well. So when you raise that bottom head, it's going to raise that fundamental of the top head, even though you didn't touch the top head, because those are coupled.
So what is this? Is this like an 18 by 18?
This is 16 by 14. 14.
Okay.
That's sort of a standard, standard floor tom. Most 18s, like 18-inch floor toms, are 16-inch deep, although I like 14 deep ones. They tend to resonate really nicely.
Okay.
How are the two heads tuned?
With a key.
Yes.
Pitch.
Well, I don't know. To where they sounded good.
Okay.
Nothing, just...
No science.
Nope. There, let's see.
There can be signs. They make all kinds of doodads and gadgets.
So this is
Drumbot and
top head looser than bottom, which is what this was, which is why we're getting some down pitch. That's fairly typical of like rock tuning, is top head looser than the bottom. And some of that's just for feel. Some guys don't like a really super tight top head. They're playing these big flammy fills, and it feels better to kind of lay into the head.
So, like, and that feel means how the stick comes back?
Just, yeah, how you're interacting with the drum while you're playing it. And if it's super tight, you're getting this...
Right.
And if you're playing really fast, that can be good, but if you're playing Journey covers, big...
One of the reasons why jazz players tune their drums so high is so that the heads are tight, because they do a lot more rolls around a kit, double strokes, and
they're better.
It helps a lot of cutting too, you know. But somebody like Buddy Rich, who was amazing, he played big drums. You know, you see a lot of jazz guys that are 18s only, and he was a different style of jazz, but he played 26-inch kick.
No, he was he's like rocked out.
Yeah, he was, and he was a maniac
As a jazz drum.
So you cut a hole in the bottom
of the head?
Some dude does that, I know.
Yeah, there are people that vent floor toms. I've never tried it. I don't know.
And they do that to shorten the decay?
Yeah.
Speed up the decay?
Yeah. Have you seen those kick port things that you put in the hole bass drum? The bass drum? They make tom
floor
port things.
I'll never try that.
Yeah, I'll never try that either. No.
for 1 year, and it was a very short-lived thing. I noticed at a lot of festivals, particularly of the younger bands, that was a thing to not have a kick drum. And dude had 52 through a hole on it, and then it had a sub kick on it.
On floor tom?
Yeah, and then was dude
his kick drum?
That was his drum. Mm-hmm. And he had a snare. He actually had a snare and then a one rack tom, but that he just was intermittently hitting it like you would a kick drum.
I'll never do that either.
Nor will I. Yeah.
But again, no rules.
No.
Right. Have you ever seen the sub dudes? Anybody here? The sub dudes?
So. Well, not in a thousand years.
Play the tambourine with a condenser mic underneath the bottom of it. He'd change the pitch with his hand. You guys amazing. Just throwing that out there. Yeah. He'd have I think it was just a condenser mic, but he's just killed. So there you go. Innovation.
Whatever works.
Creativity.
Whatever makes you happy.
Yep.
So let's have a couple more questions. We're at 11 o'clock now. A couple more and then...
Each of you, would you pick who you think is a good example of a recorded drummer that you would point, like maybe to a student and say, this is really good drumming here, really good sound?
Steve Gadd?
Who?
Steve Gadd?
Oh, Steve Gadd, yeah.
Can I tell a Steve Gadd story?
He's a hack.
I got to sit in on a dinner with him and four or five other like world-renowned drummers a long time ago, and we were talking. We were talking about school and talking about practicing. He just gotten out of rehab and was living at his mom's house in Rochester, and kept his drum set in the basement. Which Steve Gadd got his drum set in his mom's basement. That's so cool right there. There's more to this story, but I'll cut the chase. Anyway, so I asked him, I said, if he knew I was a teacher, and I said, if you could give me one word of advice about what it takes to be a great player, what would that be? And he literally took about this long. We were sitting right across a little table. He goes, and you could hear a pin drop. Practice playing slow. The best drum lesson of my life, and I swear, the next time you try and record a younger band, get them to play to a click. Even if they can't, just get them to play to a click. to, you know, they'll play better live, and then just start pulling that tempo back. Mm. Anyway, phenomenal drummer. So, still sort of the grandfather of all the super happening players on the scene.
So Steve right Gadd changed your life, basically.
Absolutely. And he's cool. Funny. That's I won't cool. tell you the other okay. part. It's kind of harsh.
Okay. Anybody else want to answer Cal's question? Who would you recommend as a drummer?
I would consider my opinion very, very uneducated, but, you know, I like John Bonham, Bill Ward.
Of course.
The drummer Ringo. For Mount Carmel, I don't know his name, but.
Mm. Okay, Don?
I'd say if somebody's out today still doing stuff, Jason McGurr from Death Cab for Cutie, because here's a guy who is in a band that tours the world, he comes home, and he takes lessons again. And he taught lessons at drum school for years, but they just got off the road in September. And 2 weeks later, he was up in D.C., up with John Fisher, pipe band drummer that he studied with for years. And he hadn't had a whole lot of time in the last 10 years or so to do anything. And they finished an album cycle, so he's off the road for a while. And he's setting up some stuff to do some sort of video teaching and some session work. Like, I gotta work on my stuff. And so if you're at that level and that's your job and you can still say, I need to work on stuff, I think that's... And he and I talk to each other every few days and we're always sending back and forth drum stuff and ideas and practice things and try this and what are you doing with your kick drum foot here and why... Like, the whole burying the beater thing. We had a 2-hour-long conversation about this last week because he's a beater burier and I'm not. And we were talking about, like, each other's kick drum sounds because we're constantly comparing recorded stuff. And somebody who doesn't stop learning, who never says, okay, I know what I need to know. You know, and Jason's never been that guy. And I think that's awesome.
Okay, Dave?
I don't know. So I like so many, see, like, I don't mind some Barry the Beater kick drum player, you know, kick drum players. I don't mind them.
I mean, there's some phenomenally successful drummers
exactly,
than Barry the Beater.
Really
that's
good.
Why we
Barry
can't
Beater,
really say that's wrong.
Yeah, no. That's what I mean. There are, you know? Like, there are so many great, really fast, really technically proficient punk rock drummers that are, they bury the shit out of that beater. They just, like, slam it into it. But, again, like, the drummer of my punk band isn't. He just doesn't bury it. He plays, you know, triplets, and he just bounces it all back, and it sounds really full, and it's great. I have a lot of favorite drummers. Like, I mean, I really like Danny Carey from Tool. Yeah, that guy is phenomenal. Like, he's still recording amazing, complex polyrhythms and that are just blow my mind all the time. It's just, I love that guy. Can't wait for the Tool record to come out.
It'll never come out.
It'll, yeah. When they tour some more because they're getting sued for something. And
right.
So I would say, as a short answer, Danny Carey. Because that guy is, he again pushes the limits of what, he's like probably 50 years old now. He's still learning.
That's not that old.
Wow.
I don't even, but what I'm saying is he's still out there learning.
Don't make me come. Ouch!
I'm not that far off, but what I mean is, like, even as somebody who has a big career and does complex things, he's still out there working and doing interesting things. So.
Okay, last question.
Oh, I was talking about for Tool. Hmm. What's up with his drum set?
Huge.
It's melted brass.
He had all of his cymbals melted down. There's one of his kits he had to turn into his hardware. Yeah. Because he wanted to keep the energy. Hey man, people get weird. He also only records at night because he thinks Tool is a lunar band. Whatever, man. keep it real, man. Just have fun with yourself, I guess.
All right, well, thank you everyone for coming, and I wanted to thank particularly Dave and SIR for bringing all of this gear. That was a big commitment, and thanks to all of our presenters.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to thank everybody at Robert Lang for being awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And all the AES members. I want to thank my mom.